You and I wrapping up a busy week on Friday, September the 27th, 2024 on Connecticut Today. I wondered up at the front of the show if former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went a bit too far during a recent event in her criticism of former President Donald Trump. CBS reporter Aaron Navarro stopped by to talk about covering Vice President Kamala Harris's White House campaign. We welcomed Carl Weber, editor of Why Books Still Matter, honoring Joyce Meskis, to chat about National Banned Books Week. And WICC meteorologist Paul Pioric updated us on the ongoing ferocity of Hurricane Helene.
Again, and happy Friday to you. So again, we begin with the side that's always saying, well, Mr. Trump's rhetoric needs to be toned down, but they don't tone their own rhetoric down. Now, for the record, I think everybody needs to calm down, because as I say in the end, when we're all dead, when we're cold, as the great Rush Limbaugh used to say, when we've assumed room temperature, our political affiliations aren't going to matter a hill of beans. Because my guess is, there's one God. Maybe there's a few of them. I don't know. I think we've all pray and proselytize about the same God. But whomever he or she or it may be, I don't think that divine being, if they exist, and I believe somebody does, is going to care whether we're a Democrat or Republican, because if this is, in fact, our final judgment, it's not going to matter. Now, having said that, I'm at a point now where I don't know whether to laugh or cry about this. Because, again, people throw around words, like I like to say, like there are certain things you shouldn't be able to say or shouldn't want to say. Like you're grabbing a handful of Skittles. I'll just take a handful of these. No. Now, what am I talking about here? Well, at the Bushnell in Hartford last night, Hillary Clinton was in town to speak, conduct a forum there. She was at the Bushnell. Chris Murphy was on stage with her. Her new book, another book. I said, we need another Hillary book, right? Yeah. Something Lost, Something Gained, Reflections of Life, Love, and Liberty. Okay, God bless her. Her and her husband are fabulously wealthy people. She's had a long history in government, and she's done fairly well. And she's angry. You have to understand something. Hillary Clinton's an angry woman. She should not have been pushed out of the way for Barack Obama. She was, and she's never gotten over that. And the inner anger she probably has, whatever, people channel their anger, not changer, Paul. People channel their anger in different ways. But again, she's throwing out, and you tell me whether, is this irresponsible or not? Because I think it's irresponsible. I honestly do. Because you're assuming something that, A, you don't know what's going to happen, and B, probably wouldn't happen in this country. Apparently, earlier in this, when was this? This was, last night. A story in the Hearst Connecticut Media Publications, Connecticut Post, by our buddy, our pal, Dan Haar. She alluded to Hillary Clinton's, she in the story, as Dan reported it, alluded to the fact that she thinks Trump's going to be a dictator from day one, which he said he'd be a dictator on day one only, firmly tongue-in-cheek, but I guess they don't get it. At least that's the way I'm looking at it. And she's throwing out the Hitler meme. I mean, this is the height of irresponsibility. Now, you can despise Donald Trump. I'm not saying you can't do that. The right has a right to despise whomever they want on the left. The left has an equal right to despise whomever they want on the right. That's the way the world goes around. And Hillary Clinton, Hillary, look, she lost to Trump. She's still burned by that. I get it. I understand it. But some of this, now here's a quote from her. Trump has said he wants to be a dictator on day one. How could anybody who has watched him not know that's what he wants to do? Now, but we don't know that. That's the thing. We don't know that. He said that it was probably tongue-in-cheek. He wants unaccountable power. How do you know that? Sure, you can say it. It may be right. But, Hillary, how do you know that? Because you don't. You can say, well, he did this, that, and the other. Well, okay, but you don't know that. You're not a deity. You're not the Almighty. You cannot see into the future. Last time I checked, we don't make crystal balls. Quote, he wants to be the person who has almost complete control over the country in a way that we have never imagined. He doesn't even know about policy. He doesn't care about policy. He wants power. Well, Senator Clinton, Madam VP, with all due respect, about half the country thinks they like his policy that you say he doesn't understand. But people understand their checkbooks and their 401ks and what stuff used to cost under him. Now, it may not be a valid measure. I understand that. Dan Haar writes here, she described what dictators do and how ruthlessly they act, especially Russian President Vladimir Putin, who Clinton contended backed Trump in his campaign against her in 2016. Okay. And you lost. As a dear friend of mine says, and he and I are on polar opposite ends of the political spectrum, he had the best analysis of 2016. He said, hey, Paul, he goes, 2016 was a battle between two eminently unlikable people. One was slightly less unlikable than the other. But again, last night, she's throwing out the Hitler comparison again, which you may say, well, she's right. Okay, but we don't know that. And her side is all, well, look at Trump's rhetoric. Look at that. Well, no, what about your rhetoric? I got more on this, some more quotes coming up. Is what Hillary Clinton said irresponsible? Comparing Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler and contending that he wasn't kidding about being a dictator only on day one. Or is does half the country just not get it about him? Not necessarily his policy, but about him. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Is it irresponsible to say if you elect this guy, he's going to be a dictator? As we move right along on a Friday edition of Connecticut Today, right here on WICC 600 AM and 95.9 FM, what's going on with the presidential campaigns? CBS correspondent Aaron Navarro joins us, who's been covering the campaign of Vice President Kamala Harris for the White House. Aaron, it's Paul here in Connecticut. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good, Paul. Good to be with you.
Well, great to have you with us. And what's the temperature of the campaign, Aaron? I know people that have covered campaigns, and a lot of times you can sense, even if you guys and gals in the traveling corps are not told, there's a sense of where things are. Where do you sense the Harris campaign is right now?
I sense that they acknowledge, while they have seen some momentum from Democratic voters, at least in the base, since she became the candidate, since the debate with Trump, they know that this is still a toss-up race in several states, seven states to be exact. Many polls show it nearly 50-50 tie or close to the margin of error in every state. So the campaign knows that they're playing within the margins. They know that most people have decided how they feel about the candidates. And they're really targeting a small sliver of undecided voters, as well as trying to maintain the enthusiasm within their base. It's a tight timeline, and it's a tight rope walk to really have in these closing weeks of the race.
It must be frustrating for some of them, obviously, working for the vice president, and you hear some of her surrogates, to know that in their eyes, they're going up against probably half the country. It's split right down the middle, Aaron, and I would imagine that some of the campaign people you talk to, maybe on or off the record, may be a little angry or a little frustrated that President Trump, or former President Trump, for whatever reason, still enjoys the base of support. And beyond the base, it's about half the country, no matter what Democrats try and do and kind of rattle at a little bit.
The campaign, at least for the Harris side, has been clear-eyed about Trump's support. And what they've been trying to do, whether it works or not, is making outreach to those more moderate Republicans, independents, that may be turned off by Trump. These may be people that voted for him in 2016 and 2020, or folks that voted for him in 2016 but maybe stayed home in 2020 or reluctantly voted for President Biden. As the campaign looks to replicate the winning coalition Biden had, they've really invested time and outreach in courting some of those more moderate Republicans, having Republicans on the road, such as former Congress members like Barbara Comstock, Joe Walsh, the former Lieutenant Governor of Georgia, Jeff Duncan, as surrogates for them to try and make the pitch to some moderate Republicans, maybe in the suburbs, that the election is bigger than party, and in their words, that Trump is a, quote, threat to democracy, and that while you may not agree with Harris, she is the right choice. We'll see if that approach works out, but it shows they're taking no vote for granted going into this November.
Aaron Navarro is the guest, a CBS News correspondent covering the Harris campaign. Aaron, her reluctance and refusal so far to do a general, traditional, wide-open, no-holds-barred news conference with you and the other folks covering, do you sense a chance that that may change? Or could they go, Aaron, do you think, the entire campaign without having, again, barring the sit-downs with specific networks, without having a traditional news conference?
I think, based off what I have seen and heard, it seems unlikely that a whole news conference would happen. The campaign has said they would do more sit-down interviews. They've done about seven so far, a mix of TV and radio and some print, as well as, you know, social media content creator engagements. But the campaign sees one of the most valuable resources for Vice President Harris is her time, whether it's doing fundraisers or campaign rallies, speaking directly to the voters. I haven't gotten the sense that they place a lot of value or priority in doing a general news conference. Now, they have been doing more local battleground state interviews so far, and it seems like that approach will continue.
Aaron, finally, have you heard anything about the invitation from 60 Minutes to do separate sit-downs with former President Trump and the vice president? Is her camp indicating whether or not there may be a final decision on that or not?
Those conversations are between the 60 Minutes folks and the Harris campaign. I have not heard any indication either way, and I will leave it to those bosses at 60 Minutes to hopefully get the deal locked down.
All right, sounds good. CBS News reporter Aaron Navarro covering the Kamala Harris campaign for the White House. Aaron, great to have you on. Safe travels, and we will talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
As we've discussed here a couple of times previously on Connecticut Today this week is being designated by some as National Banned Books Week. Of course, a lot of controversy around as to what books are allowed in what schools, what are the rights of parents, the rights of authors, the rights of the publishing houses. Joining us right now to talk about that is Carl Weber. Carl is publisher of River Towns Books. He's a writer, editor, and book developer with over 40 years' experience in the book publishing industry, and he has edited and curated a book called Why Books Still Matter, honoring Joyce Meskes, the essays on the past, present, and future of books, book selling, and publishing. Hey, Carl, it's Paul at WICC. Thanks for coming on today. We appreciate it. How are you?
Nice to be with you, Paul.
Let's talk about the book first before we get to the book banning theory here. This book, Why Books Still Matter. Why did you write it, or edit it, I should say? And the subject of the book, the dedication to this woman who I would imagine a lot of folks have not heard of. Can you explain that just a bit?
Sure. Joyce Meskes was a hero of the book world. She was the founder of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, which is a legendary bookstore in Denver, Colorado, one of the first giant stores dedicated to books, with a cafe and comfortable sofas and chairs everywhere, a real haven for book lovers. And Joyce Meskes is responsible for turning so many thousands of people into book lovers. But she was also a hero of the First Amendment. She was the plaintiff in a couple of groundbreaking cases, including one, A Tattered Cover versus Thornton, which led to the Colorado Supreme Court for the first time declaring that people have the right to read any kinds of books that they want without having government access to the records of the books they bought at the bookstore. So Big Brother can't look over your shoulder to see what you're reading. So Joyce Meskis has been a hero of free expression. And when she passed away in 2022, a group of her friends and I decided we wanted to do a book honoring her legacy. So we pulled together Why Books Still Matter, which talks about the importance of books in our culture, our society, even our politics, and also about the threats to free expression and what we can do to push back against those threats.
So, Carl, it sounds like this type of bookstore is one of the many that we have in this area that I'm sure they have across the country, even with the proliferation of online booksellers like Amazon. And your book is available, of course, on Amazon and other venues. I can probably visualize this kind of cozy, warm feeling bookstore that she started and ran.
Yes, that's right. And, it, you know, in addition to being just a warm and welcoming place, independent bookstores like The Tattered Cover are also community gathering places. They're places where authors from around the country visit to talk about their books, to share their ideas, their stories, and people from around the community can come together and learn about different ways of life, new ideas, the latest hot issues in the public sphere. So bookstores play an important role as cultural gathering places in our communities.
Let's segue, Carl, if we can. Carl Weber, by the way, is the guest. He has edited the new book called Why Books Still Matter. Carl, let's talk about the notion of National Banned Books Week. We're coming to the end of it. I had a guest on earlier in the week. We've talked about it here on the show. Are any books really banned, Carl, in this country by the government? Or is this more accurately a battle or a question of parental rights versus free and open expression? I mean, we see this play out a lot. It's played out here in Connecticut. It's played out all over the country. Is this really a question of bans, or maybe even a thornier issue was what parents want and don't want for their kids? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, these are good questions, Paul, because we use the term book banning. It's kind of a catch-all phrase, and it really describes a number of different things that happen. And book bans or attempts to censor over the years have taken many different forms and focused on different issues. There were times in American history when books were banned for their political content, like during the Red Scares of the 1920s and the 1950s. Today, book banning is taking a different kind of form. It's usually focused on what kids can get access to in schools and in school libraries, and also in public libraries, in the kids' departments of public libraries. And what we're seeing across the country is, over the last few years, a dramatic rise in the number of books that have been challenged and attacked by specific outside groups or even individuals, saying these are not appropriate for kids to get access to in schools. And the problem that many of us have, those of us who are believers in the positive power of books, is that what you have is a relatively small minority of parents who have particular views about what's appropriate for their children trying to impose those views, not just on their own kids, but on everybody. So one example is that in December of 2023, the Washington Post had a bunch of investigative reporters survey 1,000 randomly selected book bans from across the country. And what they found when they did a deep dive into the sources was that 11 individuals from across the country were responsible for more than half of those book bans. So those are folks living in random places around America who are taking upon themselves the power to control what your kids are able to read in school.
So how do we fix that, Carl Weber? What do we say to parents who say, hey, I understand literary freedom, but, you know, we have, for example, I always cite the age-appropriate levels when you go to your local movie theater about what kids should be, you know, exposed to. So what would be your suggestion if somebody's listening now and saying, hey, Carl, love you, but I don't want my 4-, 5-, and 6-year-old to be able to read certain books until they're a little older? How do we fix this?
Right. I understand that feeling, parent and grandparent myself, and have a lot of concerns about the cultural influences that my kids and grandkids imbibe. And I think there are a couple of important things to think about in terms of solution to these kinds of issues. One is that I personally, for example, would have no problem with a parent choosing to have their child opt out of a particular lesson or a part of the curriculum that they think is not appropriate. And a lot of schools have programs like that in place. And in addition, I think the other thing that school districts around the country are increasingly doing is creating a very clear and fair systems for adjudicating particular challenges. And in Connecticut right now, I understand there's a bill called HB number 5417, which would mandate that school districts have a clear and fair system whereby a challenge does not just surface out of nowhere and put pressure on principals or school librarians to immediately remove books from the shelves, but instead there's a clear process for educators and parent groups to evaluate content together and come up with fair consensus decisions about what's appropriate.
Yeah, good stuff, and I have read about that bill. Carl, thank you. We've been joined by Carl Weber. He has edited the new book, Why Books Still Matter, Honoring Joyce Meskes. Carl, thank you. We appreciate it. Take care, and hopefully we can chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Looking forward to it, Paul. Thank you.
And the voice you just heard give us our local weather forecast joins us right now to talk about just the mass destruction we're seeing on a quite large scale in Florida and now heading north of Florida a bit inland up the eastern part of the U.S. Meteorologist Paul Piorg joins us here. Paul, good afternoon. Thanks for taking the time. As always, we appreciate it.
Well, good afternoon. You know, the word is being used catastrophic, and how appropriate, Paul. You know, this storm made landfall just a little after 11 last night, and it made landfall near Perry, Florida, with winds of 140 miles an hour, sustained winds of 140 miles an hour plus. Now, what I find hard to believe, records go back to 1851, and this is the first hurricane on record to hit the Florida area we call the Big Bend, where the Panhandle meets the peninsula. The first one on record to be Category 4, and these records go back to 1851.
Yeah, and Paul, you know, when I was talking about this with somebody in the station today, I remember when I first got started out in the radio business, before I did talk, I was a street reporter, and I remember being right on Long Wharf when Hurricane Gloria came in, 1985, and a lot of people remember that was barely a hurricane. It was 75 miles an hour, just a hair above. And I remember having to cling to a payphone at the time. We didn't get our first cell phone yet, so I was at a payphone on Long Wharf, and it was all I could do, Paul, to not get knocked off of that. A cop was yelling at me to get out, but then he saw my news car. He said, okay, be careful. So when I hear 140 miles an hour,
I can't imagine that.
How do you even put that in perspective?
No. And you know what you mentioned? Ironically, that was 39 years ago today.
Wow. Wow.
On this date in 1985. And you know where I was? I was on the roof at Westcon with Dr. Mel.
Oh, wow. Wow. On the roof during this thing.
Roof.
So, Paul, what led to, I mean, obviously any tropical storm, a depression, all the way up to a huge hurricane, it's the perfect mix. But when did you and the other weather people look at this in the previous days and start to go, uh-oh?
Well, this was a good week ago. At least a week ago, because we saw the path, the trajectory of where this was going to go, and it did look 4 or 5 days ago like it was the Panhandle area of Florida that would get hit. The eastern side, you know, sure wind, rain, but the heaviest, the strongest bout would be on the western side of Florida, and it came, you know, basically right along that path. And one of the things I've been seeing today is the warnings and watches that went up. They went up well ahead of time, so people knew exactly where this was going to go. And for the most part, it landed where it was forecast to land. in that area of Florida. And when it did, as you said a moment ago, we are dealing with 140-mile-an-hour winds before midnight last night and rainfall amounts that are, you know, off the charts. We are dealing with a foot and a half of rain in some areas. In fact, some of the numbers, Paul, that just came in as far as rain goes, let's see, in northwestern Florida, in the Panhandle area, they have had more than 14 inches of rain in the last 12 hours. Northeastern Georgia, 12 to 14. Northwestern South Carolina, upwards of 16 inches of rain in about 12 hours. And near Atlanta, about 10. So they are flooded out, number one. We've seen the videos. We've seen the footage of all the damage with respect to the wind, number two. And number three, these power outages will last for a long time. You know, you mentioned a moment ago, going back to 85 in Gloria, we did not have power here in the Bridgeport-Fairfield area for 6 days.
Wow.
For 6 days. So I can imagine this being several weeks.
Wow. Paul Piorek, WICC meteorologist. Paul, thank you as always for your input, and take care and have a good weekend.
And you as well, Paul. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul Piorek. Wow. I didn't know, folks. Hurricane Gloria, 1985 on this date. Oh, man.